Blog Talk Radio.
Well, here we are, ladies and gentlemen. You're saying, well, wait a minute, it's not Tuesday, 8 o'clock Eastern out of Cleveland, Ohio. It's Thursday, 7 o'clock Eastern out of Cleveland, Ohio. Yeah, technical problems derailed us Tuesday, but here we are with the American Sports History Podcast, hosted by a brother, a mentor, and a friend to me, Peter Ray. Yours truly, Mark Mancini, in a funeral house where they just buried the Dodgers till next year in Los Angeles, 347-205-9631. If you happen to miss this, catch the archive version, blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports Podcast, platforms wherever you subscribe to the podcast, powered now by Mancini Media. So without further ado, more of him, less of me. Peter, as I lay this thing down, first of all, how are you? How can people get a hold of you? And your wife is probably happy as hell coming back from the vacation and now hearing this great guest come through.
Hi, Mark. I'm doing well. I have a YouTube channel. It's my name, Peter J. Rea. You're absolutely right. Tonight's guest played Major League Baseball from 1971 to 1981 with the Chicago Cubs, Oakland A's, L.A. Dodgers, and San Francisco Giants. He's tied for 79th all-time in career stolen bases with Dave Collins. Won two World Series with the Oakland A's in 1973 and 74. 395 career stolen bases. Two-time American League stolen base leader, 1974 and 76. More than 1,000 hits. The first Oakland A's designated hitter. He won a title, National League title in 78 with the Dodgers. Three times led the American League in total chances per game. Twice in putouts. Once in assists from the outfield on the double play. Welcome to the show for the 31st time. My dear wife Alice's favorite podcast guest, because he's a good man with a good heart and a good sense of humor, Mr. Bill North, the starting center fielder and leadoff hitter for the coolest MLB team of all time, the Oakland A's from the early 1970s.
Hey, Peter, how's your life?
Everything's fine. Bill, you said you're going to be on the Voice of America tomorrow.
Yeah, I think it's Voice America. But
Voice of, oh.
I don't know anything about it, Peter. What is that about?
Well, I know Voice of America is like international. It's broadcast internationally, but Voice
and
America.
And military, isn't it a military kind of thing?
Could be, yeah, something like that.
Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah.
Sounds exciting. Do you know what you're going to talk about?
Being interviewed. It's an honor. Of course, whenever anybody wants to talk to my butt.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing about that in 2 weeks. Bill,
we need to go to an hour, Peter.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, we don't have time. Now, I have a lot of stuff here for you. This book, I'm rereading Dynastic Bombastic Reggie Rowley Catfish and Charlie Finley's Swingin' A's. By Jason Turbo.
By Jason Turbo. Yeah.
Yes. And he had, there's this one part where he was talking about all of, you know, Charlie Finley came up with a lot of different ideas, including an orange baseball. California outfielder Bob Oliver spoke for the majority of players when he said they should take the orange baseball, wrap it in a blue blanket, and drop it in the Red Sea. Any comment?
I agree.
You agree?
That ball wasn't worth nothing. It was too slick. You'd get somebody killed.
Okay.
It didn't have a finish on it, and it was really slick.
Now
you
arrived in Oakland, 1973, and there's this chapter about 73 season. As the bus motored away from O'Hare Field, you guys started the year 3-0-3. New acquisition Billy North began feuding with Blue Moon Odom in the rear seats, the type of verbal needling with which the team was so familiar. As their digs grew increasingly antagonistic, the rest of the A's began hooting at the spectacle, egging them on. Dick Williams considered the possibility that his team would have its first fight of the season before its first victory and turned around in his seat. Are you guys 3-0 or 0-3? He barked. Instantly, the road died down. Blue Moon Odom was the only one bold enough to answer, "We're 0-3. Any comment?
He had said some other. Dick had said some other stuff in that book too about this guy just walked into the world championship team, and here he is getting ready to fight someone. And anyway, nope, I don't have any comment. Yeah, I don't think it was there was any malice in it, or we were getting ready to fight. We were just talking loud. I fit in on that side. You know, the one thing is, you're gonna either be with the Oakland A's, you were either gonna walk on somebody or you gonna get walked on.
Now, a short time later, the team left for Baltimore. Dick Williams was already seated front of the airplane when Reggie Jackson boarded and, without looking up from his newspaper, muttered, "Superstar, my ass," as the player walked past. It was the only button that needed pushing. Reggie Jackson wheeled, "Hey, man, who the heck are you to be talking to me like that? I followed the damn game my whole life, and I remember when you played and you didn't do shit. So don't lay any of your sarcastic superstar stuff on me. You just leave me alone from now on. You write my name down on the lineup card and leave me alone." Next day, Dick Williams called Reggie into the locker room, and they smoothed things out. And Reggie did very well after that. Any comment?
Yeah. I think that Dick was out of the pocket, but at least he apologized. Reggie was a player. He was different as a personality, but I call him an acquired taste. But Dick's my manager, and you know I go to the mats for him anytime. But I don't remember that. But I know that wouldn't have been fair, and what Reggie said was pretty much right. As far as Dick's baseball playing acumen, Well, but he played professional ball. He had to be something. But he was a better manager than he was a player. You can bet on that.
Now, there's another passage. So hurt was Reggie Jackson. Now, he had conflict. Reggie had conflict with Charlie Finley, with everybody else. So Sir hurt was Reggie Jackson that over the winter he visited Charlie Finley's Chicago office with the goal of forcing a trade. Reggie spent 30 minutes railing against the injustices he suffered and how things could have been different with even an iota of understanding from the owner. He was angry, bursting with things to say. Charlie Finley, having already won the battle, was not. After a time, he cut the rambling player off and offered the sort of platitudes for which Jackson had thirsted several months earlier before he'd been so thoroughly broken. "You talk for a half hour," Finley said. "I listened to everything you said. Now I'm going to talk for 30 seconds. Number one, I love you. Number two, I'm not going to trade you. Number three, let's go to lunch." Any comment?
I like that one, too. I could see that happening. But Charlie wasn't all that enamored with any of us to the point that he would acquiesce to how somebody's being treated. He'd probably laugh at him and say, You think you're mad now about this? You're going to be madder than this before it's over with.
Now, there's another passage here. Bill North was by that time, this is later in the season, actually, Charlie Finley had a heart attack in August, and then Dick Williams was getting fewer calls, so that seemed to help the team, having less meddling by Charlie Finley after his heart attack.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And Charlie used to wake him up in the morning. Bobby Winkles, when he became the manager, me and Winks got to be good friends because I was on my way out. That was my free agent year. And I was on the trading block, and Charlie wouldn't let me play because of he didn't want me. You know, if you're going to be a free agent, you're not going to make any money off of me. So he put me on the bench, and Winkles had to tell me, and he had to be with me during that time. I said, hey, man, you know, just don't miss no paychecks. But Winkles used to say, he gets a call from Charlie, 6:30 in the morning, all the time, saying, Winkles, get up out of that bed. Only hookers make money in bed.
Okay, and there's another passion.
Yeah, he used to wake Alvin up, too.
Another passage. Bill North, this is mid-season. Bill North was by that time ensconced atop the A's lineup, his base path acumen having long since earned him a starting role and relegated Bert Campanaris to the second slot in the order. On defense, Bill North ran down fly balls that A's center fielders of years past wouldn't have come close to touching. For all the stability he provided in center field and atop the lineup, the Seattle native's most notable quality was his fiery attitude. Any comment?
I was aggressive. That's all I have to say.
Okay. Yeah, it shows how important you were, stealing bases and catching all those fly balls and, you know, very exciting ball player. That's why the A's need to stay in Oakland because, I saw a thing on Facebook. There was a Ed Cranepool and this other New York Met. They were selling books in New York, and I thought, oh, they're still popular, and the 69 Mets are still popular in New York. And I thought, here, you guys won 3 World Series, and there shouldn't be any talk of you guys leaving because, you know, here I'm a Cleveland fan. I remember you guys so well, and just imagine the Oakland fans must, remember you much better. And if you leave, that's going to be broken for telling their sons and grandsons about what you guys did.
Two things. Back to the leadoff hitter. I see leadoff hitters now in baseball that don't understand. A lot of them don't understand what they mean to the whole lineup. And I told you before, we drove a Cadillac. I mean, Reggie Jackson and Sal Bando and Joe Rudy and Gene Tennyson, those guys, we drove a Cadillac. But it wasn't going anywhere until I turned it on. And that aggression from your leadoff hitter permeates the lineup. And it's almost non-existent in the game today, except for Acuna.
Uh-huh.
You know, and 50, those are great stats. I love that. 51 home runs and 70 stolen bases. Great numbers. but I can't remember. What was the second part, Pete?
I don't know. You had two things in mind. I don't know what you're thinking about.
But, okay. We had a pretty good time. Yeah.
Now, continuing. Go ahead.
Happened there.
Yeah.
Yeah. He wasn't real happy about that.
Oh, being knocked to number 2?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't real happy. It cost me a lot of. I had 500 stolen bases. At 1 year, I had stolen 100.
Right, right.
But he didn't want me to run. So I love him. I mean, he's a great player, and I love to play with. But between he and I, he said I wouldn't steal more bases than he did, and he did all the time. But that was the kind of thing that, you know, I never had to. The manager had to deal with that, and they tried to, and it never worked. And,
continuing, Bill North's teammates had been introduced to his fiery personality months earlier. After becoming the starting center fielder in late April, North sizzled through the end of May with a .324 average and 10 stolen bases. In a May 18th game against the Royals at the Coliseum, however, he let slip his bat on a swing against reliever Doug Bird, the lumber sailing harmlessly between the mound and third base. While going to retrieve it, however, Norris took an unexpected right turn and pounced upon the unsuspecting pitcher, peppering him with as many punches as he could land before being tackled away by players from both teams. The only guy in the building who wasn't confused as hell was the guy swinging his fists. The feud dated back to 1970 when Bill Norris played for the Quincy, Illinois Cubs of the Single-A Midwest League. Bird, pitching for Waterloo, Iowa, had given up homers to the two players preceding North in the lineup and responded by brushing North back. "Hey, man, I didn't hit those homers," he snapped at the catcher before settling back into the box. The next pitch, a fastball, hit him in the head with such velocity that North required hospitalization. He'd been waiting keenly for revenge ever since, paying close attention to the transaction wire for the moment Bird was called up from the minors. The fight occurred during the pitcher's fourth major league appearance. "I don't think I could live with myself and not challenge that dude," North said afterward. Such certainty did not grip his teammates. "We were all looking at each other going, what the hell is happening?" said Joe Rudy. Added Ray Fossey, "We're trying to win a championship. And when we found out Bill Norris doing something to redress a problem from the minor leagues, we couldn't believe it." Joe Cronin suspended Bill Norris 3 games and fined him $100. Any comment?
No.
Okay.
I mean, it speaks for itself. I knew those comments by Fossey. But,
you
know what? I'll bet you any of the players on that team that had that experience and had enough guts to fight would have done the same thing.
Did you tell them that?
You can't let somebody. You can't. I mean, it. When you get hit in the head by somebody and they get it on purpose, that's pretty treacherous territory. And I will never sit there and let anybody throw at my head. Again, I got hit in the head 6 times, but I consider only one of them having done it on purpose. There's a place where a pitcher can throw a ball if he's got enough velocity that there's not a damn thing you can do to not get hit in the head. And I experienced that 6 times. And no wonder I'm so crazy. But,
same thing
but
here.
This guy did it on purpose. And it was not, when I went to the mound, it was not unsuspecting. I went straight there, and the first thing I told him, he says, "I remember you walking to the mound." And he said, "That pitch wasn't even close to you." He remembered me also. I said, "I remember you from Waterloo, Iowa." He started to say something, but I was there by then. And what happened. I faced him 8 times, and I told him, "You better never pitch me inside again." So there was a strategic, because I liked the ball out over the plate anyway.
Right.
I didn't want him inside. And I faced him 8 times for the rest of the season. I got 5 hits and 3 walks.
Okay. Right. Well, that's good. I watched baseball seasons 1970. The Orioles beat the Reds in the World Series 4-1. Vida Blue had a no-hitter in his 8th career start. Doc Ellis threw a no-hitter and said he was on LSD. Brooks Robinson made tremendous plays in the World Series. And there was it showed the ball girl or the ball the base sweeper
Mary
sweeping
Barry and Debbie Sivier, yeah,
sweeping Brooks Robinson's shoes. And Paul Blair was interviewed and said, quote, "We made the big red machine a little toy wagon."
I love it. Yeah, so do we.
Yeah, have you ever seen anything like Brooks Robinson's play in the World Series where he went into foul territory and threw out the, I think it was Lee May, threw out a guy?
Come on, man. Brooks Robinson? I got a picture of me hitting the ball past Brooks Robinson. I took that picture to him, and I had him sign it. And he signed it. I don't know where it is now. But it was not a way to make a living hitting the ball down on Brooks Robinson. You, if you're going to do that for your career, you got to get another job. Brooks Robinson, those plays, that play he made on Lee May, though, is one of them. I mean, Brooks couldn't run, didn't have a real good arm, but he had a great first step. And when he put his hands on the ball, it was on. But what a great player and a wonderful man. And I'm so sorry to see him go, and I want to tell the Robinson family that he was a heck of a leader and a heck of a player, and I was so proud to be on the field with him.
Yeah, I love that play, him going in foul ground. And I love the photograph of him jumping after they won the 66 World Series. He's way up in the air. And he's a good guy. So, yeah, that's the thing people liked about him, as, aside from his incredible play.
Toughest thing I ever had to do in my career, Peter, was play against the Baltimore Orioles.
Right.
Those guys were tough, man. You had Merv Rettman, and then Bobby Gritch and Mark Belanger, and they left the grass long, so you weren't hitting a whole bunch through that infield.
Right.
And then they put sand in the base path where I would be taken off for if I was going to steal a base. There was sand there, or they put mud in there underneath to and they tilted the field. And as far as bunting, if you bunted the ball down the third baseline, they had that so it would run, the ball would go foul.
Okay.
Hey, man, that was back in the day when them groundskeepers were magicians.
Mm-hmm.
But that Baltimore thing, hey, man, Jim Palmer and Cuellar, come on, man, those guys were pretty good.
Yeah, they really were, the Baltimore Orioles. Yeah, I was rooting for Baltimore in the playoffs, but they're gone. Although, actually, I'm going to be rooting for Texas now against Houston because they haven't won anything since the team started in 72, But anyway, yeah, I remember the Orioles well from the 70s.
That puts us at odds, Peter.
Right. Respect for the noble opponent.
Yeah, but that puts us at odds because you're going for Texas.
Right.
I'm a Dusty Baker fan.
Right. Well,
and you know that, Peter.
Right. Well, that's okay. It's okay. We can you know, be on different sides, but still have respect and friendship and goodwill. And if Houston wins, I'll be definitely happy for you and for him, you know, because
that would be wonderful.
Now, the greatest players of the 70s, number 135, Ramon Hernandez. I don't know anything about him. Does that name ring a bell?
Ramon Hernandez was a left-handed relief pitcher for the Pittsburgh Pirates. Him and Joel Horner were kept in baseball in the National League to pitch to Billy Williams and Willie McCovey and maybe Stargell. But okay. I know when I came up with the Cubs that Ramon Hernandez was, he was with the Pirates, and he would come in to pitch to Billy. We were playing the Pirates one game late in the game, Ferguson Jenkins pitching, and scores 2-2. And Billy came in the eighth inning, or the top of the ninth inning. Billy came into the dugout when we got him out and went up to Jenkins and said, "I'm going to get this one for you."
Uh-huh.
And when he went to the plate, they brought Ramon Hernandez in.
Okay.
And Ramon Hernandez was notorious. for getting them left-handers out. Billy Williams, after two strikes, that slider he threw, because he dropped down, he threw from the side. On the third strike, there was a pitch 6 inches at least off the outside of the plate. Billy went out and got it like he was sticking a shovel in the ground and throwing dirt over his shoulder and hit the ball out of the ballpark.
Mm.
One Dang. Of the greatest pieces of hitting that I ever saw.
Uh-huh.
But the only thing that was the matter was that Pittsburgh had the bottom of the nut.
Oh.
And Jenkins had put one man on base in front of a guy who wore the number 21. His name was Clemente.
Okay.
And Clemente said a two-run home run out of right center field, and they won the game.
Okay. Well, that was that's
my Ramon Hernandez memory.
That's a good one. How about Rick Monday?
Teammate.
Uh-huh.
Hollywood. Yeah. He went to the Cubs. We were together in the went to the Cubs for Holtzman, and I went the next year. I went 2 days from for Bob Locker.
Right.
We played together in '78.
Right.
In that World Series down there in Dodgers, at the Dodgers. And he was a good center field.
Okay, another guy, Gary Nolan.
Gary Nolan. Gary, Cleveland?
Reds pitcher.
Oh, yeah. Oh. What's Gary Bell is the one I was thinking about.
Right.
Gary Nolan. I don't know too much about him, Pete.
Okay. Number 136, No, 138, Dusty Baker.
Where do you want me to start? I met Baker in Arizona. It's 1969. We got to be friends. He was a kind of player that a winning team had to have because he spoke fluent Spanish. And there's a lot of times, and he was a team leader, and there's a lot of times when, and I'm not being racial, but if somebody is unhappy, he could start talking to the other Latin players but it happens, you know. There are other players, you know, they do that in English too. I think one of the greatest keys to winning a championship, especially back in those times of having a winning team, was to have an African American player that spoke fluent African American player that's prominent that spoke fluent Spanish, because it stops the locker room from clicking up, you know,
right?
Because guys, oddly enough, white dudes do that, black dudes do that, but a lot of them can't understand when the Spanish dudes are doing
right.
that, and it's the kind of thing that when I was with the Dodgers, he was really good at keeping the team balanced as far as not – the Dodgers had cliques anyway, but not letting any toxic stuff happen. And on teams in baseball, you know, that's one of the things is there's winning is infectious, and losing is insidious. And the difference between the two when they're winning, the guys on the bench are called role players. When they're losing, the guys on the bench are called dissenting ball players because they always think that they could do a better job than the guy out there when you lose it. And that's the kind of thing that you have to has to be controlled. And because there's a lot of insecurities in the game.
Our guest has been Mr. Bill North, the center fielder and leadoff hitter for the coolest MLB team of all time, the Oakland A's from the early 1970s. We had nice comments from Joey from Bucks County, Pennsylvania. Bill brings the swag. Sam from Germantown, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, fellas. Lance from Pensacola, Florida. He's talking about the playoffs. And, Bill, we're out of time. Do you have any final words for our audience?
Remember the North Legacy Project. Look it up online and donate if you can. And I look forward to being on Voice America tomorrow at 9 o'clock.
We look forward to hearing about that also. Next week we're going to have Matthew DiBiase. We're going to talk NFL history. Pete Carroll with coach the Jets, Patriots, Seahawks. Tom Coughlin coached the Jaguars and Giants. They both won Super Bowls. And it's been another wonderful having Bill North on the show tonight. It's a gift having the guy, a very important guy from the coolest MLB team of all time, the Oakland A's from the early 1970s, the leadoff hitter and center fielder and stealing a lot of bases and playing tremendous center field. What tremendous having you on the show. And, Mike, again, my dear wife Alice's favorite podcast guest because you're a good man and you have a good heart with a good sense of humor. Thanks so much, Bill.
See you, Alice. Thank you so much, Peter. I enjoy you. Thank you, fans. Because you don't have to listen to us.
Right. That's right.
We appreciate that you do. So.
Yes, we do. Thanks so much, dear fans. Dear listener, may the road rise to meet you. May the wind be at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face and rains fall soft upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. Good night again, everybody. Thanks again so much, Mr. Bill North.
Thank you.
Wonderful.